I'm going to read, the things I was going to read changed all because of this conversation we had this morning. So I'm going to read some work that's newer, sort of in response to some of the things I was thinking about today. I want to open just with a short poem. The poem is called Postscript, but I hope it also works as a sort of invocation or opening poem. Postscript. Of course, nostalgia. Of course, brooding. Give me the missing scattered through 12 states and 3 continents. Give me those scattered as ash. Give them their places at the table I have set for them as much as for those gathered. How little it takes, a year, 10 years, a shiver fast passing and the eye clears. What was love once casts off disguises, a cardinal's flare against forsythia simplified by snow. What once was love spurns shallow guises and returns, startling as love. And I'm going to read a few poems from my book, Nostos. Patrick and I were talking a lot this morning about class and about sort of different circumstances of growing up. Some of the poems that are in one of the earlier sections of this book deal with, they're set, the speaker's a child, they're set in childhood, and I'll read a couple of those and then a few poems from the end of the book. This is a poem spoken from the point of view of, you have to imagine, a child of about 12. And I grew up on a family farm, so that this is in that setting, which I think becomes clear pretty quickly. The poem is called Grown. I didn't want to grow and have the work she had. I was old enough to set the table, a glass of wine marking her place, my own mug of wine and water to learn on, laying the small tined fork by my plate. But she had to shift the clattering pots crowding the stovetop and stir the measured cornmeal, careful not to shush the water's rolling boil. Without scalding her wrists, she soaked the fatty beads off the broth by dabbing bread crusts on its skin. The cheese fell to her hands, stronger circles against the grater's graveled side. When you are grown, you buy the salt, the oil, the wine. When you are grown, you type letters in an office to buy whatever you can't raise. Come home from work, you take off your uncomfortable shoes. Some nights you hold a sobbing child and sing, Papa's Gone a-Hunting, rocking in the wicker chair. Or tie a stiffened apron over your oldest clothes. I did not want that work. Grown meant alone. The father wasn't coming back, and you were left the hunter of rabbits. Red flecking your cheeks, you'd carry a covered basket from their hutch. A blade along each throat would stop their cries. Your only help a girl, flinching, blood shy. And then I will read from a later section in the book. I've always described the third section of this book as, it's a section of elegies, and I've always described it as being like a trip to the underworld. So that's kind of what I wanted it to seem like. And I was trying to, I was trying to imagine, what might an afterlife be for someone who was a secular person. So a lot of these elegies in this book are for my father. And so this is one that, that I was trying to think, well, what would his experience in an afterlife be? And there's an Italian phrase I have to explain. The phrase is "L'erb voglio non cresce mai nel giardino del re," which means "the flower called I want doesn't even grow in the king's garden." And this is this phrase that you, like, if your child says to you, "Mama, mama, I want whatever," you smack your child and you say, "Yeah, the flower called I want doesn't even grow in the king's garden. Get out of the house. Go." So that phrase will come up in here, and then you will know what it is. And there's another little, there's an image in here There's an image in here of a wheelbarrow, which is actually a quote from one of my father's letters. So when you hear that, you'll know what that is as well. The better half of man. The flower called I want blooms not within the gardens of paradise, nor do its roots number here among purgatory's narrow beds, where the soul descended cleanses itself with soil and a rake. To accompany his loneliness, one newcomer sings lullabies until stilled by the lettuce's indifference to song. The flower called I want blooms not. These phrases of his mother, carried over the water, wither, so he buries them beside the onion. The onion, whose single word is a copper bolt demanding tears. In this middle world, day is ever day without change. Night is ever night. What he feels lisping as time is his tongue returning its verbs. Across the mullioned greenhouse walls, his image flashes, and he perceives he's slow becoming a creature, half man, half wheelbarrow, the better half of each. The better half of man is silent, and the barrow bears his load. Without voice, he grows a purer ear for the thorn's cry, hold me. Within, his last worldly solace of poise is torn, human, weep, by the onion's plangent command. Okay, I'll read you a later poem from the book. This is a funny poem. Someone asked us at the reading in Portland yesterday if poets should write more happy poems. And I was like, yes, damn it, yes, we should. We should write more happy poems. I'm just waiting for that happy poem to come. So this is actually, this is a happy poem. This is one of those, it's a sonnet, it's a love poem. I thought it was important to end the book on a love poem. And there's a whole sequence of poems in this book that are dedicated to my husband. So this is the poet, Anthony Deaton, a Fish House poet. You can read his work on Fish House. Tune in and read, and you can hear him, too. What do you need to know about this? The title comes from music. The title of this piece is Adagio ma non troppo, which those of you who are musicians will know means slowly, but not too slowly. And this is one of those poems that it's really just a description of something you've seen. You know, you feel like all I have to do is describe this kind of crazy scene because the scene itself is the poem. It's just the description. So Tony and I lived for a while in Italy. We were lucky enough to live in Florence, and we had this wonderful back view. And so this is something that I saw. Adagio ma non troppo. Golden-throated birds, their ripe warbling fluid as the new oil pressed from the olives, welcome dawn to my neighbor's courtyard by scrabbling through a plastic sack of trash. Giving the junk a picking over, they uncover evidence of that eternal act once celebrated by Etruscan lovers here. Three condoms, all one night's work? I wince as a starling stabs his horned claw through, gets caught, then pecks frantically to untie his ridiculous monumental shoe. What a parody of how desire dies. But the wife downstairs, to whom the trash belongs, warbles nightly, proving me wrong. Okay, so I'm going to read. This is a section of the book that that Matt was describing. It's a book called The Monongahela Book of Hours. It's the entire book is written in these 10 line sections. So you have to. Is that Alicia? Hi, I'm so glad you're here. Wow, that's very exciting to see you. The fragments or sections of this poem are in these 10-line movements, and it kind of goes all over the place. And I'm saying it's 110 pages long, which is really too long, so I suspect some of it must go. This is from a section called Villa of the Mysteries, and you may be familiar with the Villa of the Mysteries, which is one of the buildings in Pompeii. It's a villa that has these really remarkable frescoes on the walls. There are these incredibly well-preserved frescoes. And the room is red, and there is what we sort of think is an initiation scene in a Dionysian ritual. So there are these, it's a sort of fresco that goes all the way around the room, and there's a kind of narrative that's happening. But we're not really sure. I mean, people have speculated that it might be this, it might be that, we're not sure. One of the nice things about having this husband who lives in Naples, it's not great that he's so far away, but we live right near Pompeii. That's very nice. So Pompeii is like right over there. So I got to spend some time at the Villa of the Mysteries. And I was, so living near Pompeii, I was also thinking about how, what is it like to be a female in American culture? What is it like to be an American female? And then, you know, I was thinking one of the things that is sort of particular to a lot of American lives is I think we don't have a lot of rituals to mark things. You know, there's sort of, we're a culture that doesn't really mark a lot of important moments of passage. I mean, we have baptisms maybe or something like that, weddings, and then funeral rites. But there, you know, in a lot of other cultures, you'd have these various stages of your life marked with some kind of ritual. So I was thinking about what are those rites for an American female these days? So thinking back on younger experience. What else do you need to know? In the first one that I'm going to read, this is kind of a PG-13 poem. And there are a couple of places where it's a little bit naughty, but in the first one, this is just a literal translation. I didn't make this up. It's what's in Latin on the wall. And there are mentions of Flora, Ovid, and Horus. Flora is the Roman god of the changing season, goddess of the changing seasons. Ovid is the author of the Metamorphoses and other things. And Horus is the poet who, among other things in his odes, he has a number of sort of kind of nasty remarks about middle-aged women. So as I become a middle-aged woman, I find myself responding to that a little bit. So, and this is several sections of this poem. Villa of the Mysteries. We're in the Villa of the Mysteries. Frescoes here teach the bridal rituals. Ignorance whips a fearful girl across a threshold where goats suckle a satyr's fingers in moist glee. Older women hold a bowl of fruit squeezed around a phallus. Across town, the lesson's cruder. In the brothel, some gladiator scratched lines whose haste lends a tang of truth. All through the vintage, Veneria blew Maximus. Both her holes stay empty, but her mouth's well stuffed. The graffiti still teases, but the walls don't tell which room best taught the mysteries. USA 1980-something. Oh, endless the tedium of sophomore science. Rolling balls of different mass down inclines, displacing water in beakers with wooden blocks. No wonder at that age in vectors or velocity. No wonder the fast kids took drugs to loosen gravity, giving the time-space continuum a little warp. In the planetarium's dark, the school stars French-kissed. Some of us couldn't get the laws of motion. Others got down while the prima mobile rolled over, heavy breathing muffling the machine's clicks. Was the revolution happening before the prom? No one in the Marxist studies group around my parents' table knew. History, I was learning, rarely comes on time. So I screwed up my Coke bottle-lensed courage and asked the big question of a loner boy at school. After that, his journal, shared in sips before a flood of confidence, traced a life whose anarchy in 16 years outsmashed all theories I'd teethed on. And the poem and the power his scrawled poems held to swell or crush me bound us even closer than the virginity we'd swap to Billy Bragg's Workers' Playtime, side B. My collegial Mr. Levity of Gravity. The holy sweaters he wore with downbeat flair, the skateboard he rode everywhere, the vegan omelet he cooked me the first morning we found ourselves naked in his off-campus room. His telescope and books on chess, Li Po, his ancient iguana. Where is he now? I'm galaxies away, enough to lyricize the giggly science of our light years. He cuts the base off a plastic bottle, screws a little bowl into its cap, packs the bowl, oh, dopey love, then ducks the bong halfway in a water pail. He gives me the first hit. Sigh, he holds my hand while I inhale. He was surprised, the classics professor, when I led him to a green plot behind the building. More when I pushed him back and straddled him. Night, an unexpected garden in the city, a pretty girl you hardly know kneeling over your face, wife and son in another world. Odysseus, your ship's already riven on the rocks. After he came, it began raining, softly, then a torrent. Some instinct made me scoop a handful of mud and sign from his shoulders to the hips I rode still with a giant X. The town drunk was my true love. He slept every night in my arms. His tongue inside my body lapped the liquor of my girlhood up. But now only the owl sees him under the moonshine, weeping. When he wakes alone in the road at dawn, only she hears him pray. Poor boy, let the river wash him. Let the river wash him away. So this, there's another section here where we go into a little bit more of the Villa of the Mysteries. And this is what's being described in this section is, again, some of these images you would see on the fresco walls there. And I think the only thing you need to know is a thyrsus is one of those staffs with ivy leaves and things twined around it. Like the Dionysian initiate in the fresco, blindfolded and led through painted rooms where the sistrum's moan counterpoints the whip's shrieking until a dish of honeyed figs at last is fed her and her wounds are balmed. You know you've crossed a threshold. But to what? No goddess hands you a thyrsus marking your passage. Spring arrives yearly without sacrifice, while the double star our ancients named the winking demon bats its eyelids in the dark. And then some time has passed. Present day. Artless demi-creatures. At 16, we'd sport like animals, then plump our pillows, smooth the shame-faced teddy bears. And now, when my students file in wearing t-shirts printed with kittens or poo clutching his honeypot, cropped to bear their navel rings, they evoke that last grab at girlhood. That threshold where toothy blowjobs overlap homesick devotion to toys. How old was Flora when the wind god tore her from her flowers? My students flip their cell phones off and their pages to Ovid. I start my lecture absent-minded, reminded again that I'm no longer the mystery center. For this one, you just need to know that the word grigio means gray. Horace, I'm dumping you for a while. You said it. The sweet things boys call to at night from the alley could, had I played different cards, be my daughters. But the body old enough to have borne them isn't yet ready to lock the shutters and limp off to bed alone. Grigio, 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 a cricket counts the hairs I pluck. Though in the piazza, I still turn heads. The city's a heart, and for a few more seasons, I'm its heat. After that, I tell myself I won't miss the full moon because you, Horace, will be waiting for me then. I think I'll finish there. Thank you.